This episode was made possible by our incredible patrons. Their faithful support allows us to continue the work of amplifying the voices of spiritual abuse survivors. We are a small team composed of two families. We committed early on to not monetizing any of the stories, so we rely solely on the donations of our Patreon community to operate. If you value the work and are able to contribute, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Another way to support Bodies Behind the Bus is by following, rating, and reviewing the podcast. It only takes a moment, but has a tremendous impact on our reach. Thank you for daring to listen.
Next week is the Southern Baptist Convention's annual meeting. It has been a year since the release of the damning and illuminating Guidepost Report. Today's episode is full of information about SBC structure, cultural and systemic values that have contributed to the SBC abuse epidemic, and why it's so hard to implement change. Most importantly, we're going to be talking about how everyone, including those of us outside of the SBC, can partner with advocates to fight for safeguards. Tomorrow evening, June 8th, we will be hosting a live moderated Zoom call for anyone with questions or wanting to dive deeper. You can find event info as well as a ton of amazing resources in today's show notes. Grab a pencil and a notepad, take notes, and don't be afraid to get uncomfortable today. I'm Jonna Harris, and this is At the Bus Stop by the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast. Hello, welcome back to the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast. We have a really special, unique episode today. It's just Jonna today, but I have three amazing humans with me here, and we are talking all about abuse reform and getting some standards in place within the SBC, but also maybe the church at large and how we can start to reorient ourselves as the church to protect the vulnerable. If you guys have all been paying attention to anything in the media, especially SBC related, you'll know that there has been a ton of reporting on abuse that has occurred within that institution. And the people that are on this call today care a lot about that for various reasons. So first, I'm going to reintroduce David to you all. He was a storyteller with his wife, Margaret, on the podcast, and he is a former pastor from within the SBC. Awesome dude. I have Emily, who's also been on the podcast. She was on At the Bus Stop episode. We talked about Robin Hood. It was awesome. Go listen to that if you haven't. And I have our friend Keith, who is a pastor in Maryland. And he is working really hard within his state, correct me if I'm wrong, convention. Is that the right word? State convention. I'm learning a ton about all of these new words within the SBC governance and all that jazz while we were prepping for this episode. So he has been working specifically to get some protocols in place for some standards for churches. Like, what do we need in place to help putting in systems and safety standards to protect children, vulnerable adults from sexual abuse within their churches. So with that, I'm going to give you each just a chance to expand a little bit on why you're in this conversation with me, who you are, what you do, your experience within the SBC, and then we'll dive right in. David, do you want to start?
Sure, why not?
Cool.
Yeah, so I was born and bred in the SBC. My father is to this day a pastor in a Southern Baptist church. I went to a Southern Baptist college and seminary and was a pastor in the SBC for about 12 years. So the appellate former pastor definitely applies. We'll see whether or not that remains permanent, but that's neither here nor there. I was ordained in the SBC, educated in SBC institutions, and still very much love the local churches that make up the Southern Baptist Conventions. This is a conversation that's very near and dear to me.
Awesome. Thanks. Emily, do you want to expand a little bit on your involvement with the SBC, your lifelong involvement?
Sure. Like David, I am a PK. all of my first jobs were SBC. I worked for our state convention as a teenager and a college kid. Went to an SBC college. Also, have been on staff or have been the immediate family member of a pastor in SBC churches in multiple states. You know, just involved at the state convention level, grew up going to convention, and really started to be involved in this sort of national conversation, beginning with Jules Woodson, and just sort of linking some things from my experience as a woman in the SBC and knowing survivors personally to sort of putting those national pieces together. It's something that I care a lot about. It's something that, that I'm in long term until it's dealt with or until God deals with it for us, whatever that looks like. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
Awesome. Thanks. And Keith, can you tell us a little bit about your involvement with the SBC and also what you've been working towards?
Sure. I grew up in a Baptist church, not a Southern Baptist church. And we were always distant from our denomination because we felt like our more conservative theology didn't line up with our denomination. And so when I came on staff at the church I grew up in 2003, my pastor said, go find us a denomination. And we were going to go EV Free, Christian Missionary Alliance, or Southern Baptist. And this was just a couple of years after 9/11, and Southern Baptists were pouring into New York City. And there were a lot of meetings, a lot of people. And so we affiliated. I moved and I've been the pastor of Harvest Baptist Church in Salisbury, Maryland for 16 years now. In that time, I've been on the board of my local association. I have been involved in my state convention and just, you know, have dealt with several abuse situations over the years as a pastor, some within the association, you know, and just I've not had much special training, but I'm, you know, as an associational missionary, which is the title that I have as our associational leader, when pastors have got questions, they call, you know, and so they say, should I make a report? What should I do? You know, and so I've dealt with a number of situations like that. I didn't really know anything about this conversation nationally. I missed the Houston Chronicle. I missed a ton of stuff and just decided I was going to cut back on my Facebook activity in 2020 because Facebook had really turned into what I thought was the bad place. And I thought, hey, I'll jump on Twitter. That should be fun. And I discovered Southern Baptists on Twitter fighting and arguing. And I suddenly discovered, oh my goodness, our house is on fire. What is happening here? And jumped in and got involved. So after the Nashville meeting in 2021, where the messengers voted for the investigation, a friend of mine went to our state convention and we submitted a resolution that we would stand with survivors of abuse and that we would seek to eliminate all forms of abuse from our churches. Our state exec put together a task force and he put me on it. And then as an associational leader, I'm probably already going too long, but we developed five what we call safety standards or essentials, which are guiding our efforts that you would train workers in the local church, that you would screen anyone who's going to be working with children, that you'd have policies, behavioral policies in place that protect people, protect children and vulnerable adults. It's not just, hey, we checked. It's this is the way that people are expected to behave. These are the rules that they're expected to obey. And then you have to have a plan to report. You have to know who your local law enforcement is. You need to know what's required of you in case something happens, and your church, everybody in your church and all your volunteers need to know what to do if something happens. And then you need a plan to care. So often what happens is that I was just on the phone with somebody today discussing the fact that when this person's child disclosed, what happened was immediately everybody stopped talking to them. And we've got to be ready as pastors to listen and to support and to come alongside and to help. So our state convention, I'm just been thrilled with the support of our state staff. We're going to vote on a constitutional amendment for the second time in October at our annual meeting. I believe it's October, and it's going to require that churches affirm that they have these policies in order to be affiliated with our convention. And so we're kind of in a race to be the first convention to put that in place and to institute these policies. So yeah, that's me. And that's what we've been working on.
I love all that. I think it's amazing. And throughout the conversations getting ready for this episode, I, one, had to be completely schooled on what everything you just said even means. Like, what is a convention? What do you mean by like voting on these different things? All that stuff is like super foreign to me. So if any of you are listening right now, some of you might even be in an SBC church and not even know that. Like, it's like you might be so far removed from all of the nitty gritty here. So I promise you, we're going to get into that a little bit so that all of us can get like a baseline understanding of how this stuff works. I'd love to just talk a tiny bit about why we wanted to do this episode. So you guys have your annual meeting coming up. The SBC does at large, right? National. Is that what you guys call it? An annual meeting?
It's the annual meeting.
We do call it an annual meeting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm like, is there some like special secret name for it or, you know, Illuminati type stuff?
some people would say that this is the only 2 days of the year that the convention, which is what we're called, a convention, that it actually exists because the messengers are there. Yeah,
which technically is true.
Technically. Yeah.
So for the listeners, this is how removed I was. I literally just always thought it was Southern Baptist Church until like this week. Like, not this week, I guess like 2 weeks ago, whenever we talked about doing this episode, I was like, oh, it's the Southern Baptist Convention. Didn't even know that. So I think it was Emily who reached out to me and was like, we should teach people what all this stuff is and like how people can support efforts to make change within the SBC. And it's so big. It's just such a massive amount of churches and people, especially within America, that are involved in these churches. Clearly, I believe that people and voices and numbers matter. So if we can educate the masses and if we can all collectively start to kind of learn and grow and have expectations, I actually truly do believe that can make a change. So I think we should ruffle some feathers, light a few good fires, and teach some people how we can make some changes. To get there, though, we need to talk a little bit about the past. Would one of you guys like to talk a little bit about like a brief history of abuse within the SBC?
Yeah, I think that we have to start with the founding of the SBC, which is basically Baptists divided. So I grew up believing that we were founded to send missionaries, which technically is true, but it's only part of the truth. The other part of that truth is we were founded so that we could send missionaries who owned slaves because some other Baptists didn't want to do that. And so, yes, we were founded as a group of churches banding together to send missionaries, but it had the underpinnings of allowing and enabling slavery even within our missionaries. And like I said, like SBC princess, like all the things growing up, did not know that till I was a whole adult taking Baptist history in college. Whether we want to say that it is or not, it is in the fabric of our DNA as a convention. And it's something that when we are founded in the commodification and dehumanization of other image bearers for the sake of our mission, that is going to work into the DNA of how we deal with things like abuse. And there are still a lot of people in leadership who think abuse is bad and really want to deal with it and have not come to terms with the abuses of power and the abuses of people that happened during the conservative resurgence and the marriage of those two things within our culture more recently. So then, you know, when you have things like survivors who were at Southeastern when Paige Patterson was there, Southwestern when Paige Patterson was there, or, you know, have pastors who are trained under people who did those things, like, of course, we're not going to handle abuse well because we haven't handled power and human beings in our care well institutionally. And so I think a lot of that covering up and pushing things aside, it springs from those two things in our old past and our recent past. And so you have this buildup of years and years and years of clergy abuse, abuse within churches that's reported to clergy and handled wrongly, abuse at our seminaries and our colleges and our camps. And then the Houston Chronicle comes along. Even though there's been, you know, little things, there have been all these cracks in the dam, and the Houston Chronicle just burst the water. But I really think that where we're at is a reckoning of, are we going to be a people who call our founding good unequivocally without telling the whole story of it? Are we going to be a people who call the ends justify the means of the conservative resurgence good when we have a savior who marries the means and ends together in his person and accomplishes the ends through the goodness of the means, right? And so I think the abuse scandal, for lack of a better word, is actually a culmination and a reckoning of those things that are actually woven throughout all parts of SBC life. That's probably a more opaque answer than you were looking for, but I think it's the best explanation.
If I could echo some things that Emily said, you know, this is one of the questions that I asked. I drove into New York City to the Metro New York offices when I was investigating. I met with a gentleman named Gary Frost and asked him, hey, you know, like, what is going on with the SBC and slavery? And he said, well, you know, there was an apology that we made a couple of years ago. And I was like, okay. And it the impression that I got was like, I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, like near New York City, very, you know, Sesame Street, my upbringing, you know, a very integrated feeling society. And to me, it was like, okay, you know, like this is, we've turned the corner on this. You see the echoes of the past when the institution is more important than an individual. A friend of mine says that in the megachurch culture or in modern church culture, often the prophet, the pastor, is more important than the people, that preserving or protecting the leader becomes key. That's true at times, but we see it in the fact that often, sometimes preserving the church itself is more important than caring properly when a leader or an individual has been wronged. And there have been good pastors who've been run off by extremely horrific churches. And it's because the attention is not on individuals or people. And I think that's where we see this. We see it all over evangelicalism, how people are used as commodities. And to me, that's an echo of the past. And it maybe it shows how consumeristic our contemporary culture is, that we prefer our institutions to thrive and continue and not slow down to care enough about people. What I think affected me early on, jumping on Twitter, was seeing the tweets and the stories of people saying, no one is paying attention to this, I'm being ignored, you know, like, I've tried, I've emailed, I've gone to meetings. And that's just not the convention or family of churches and people that existed in my mind. Like, this is not who we are. This is not how as we've been told, the best denomination, the best, most effective church planting organization, missionary sending organization, you know, the most faithful to the scriptures denomination that's out there. This is not how you don't ignore the cries of the hurting or the individual. That's just not consistent. And so no, something has to change.
Yeah, I completely agree. And jokes aside, like, I'm intentionally letting the two experts speak in before I do. All I will add to that is that when, you know, Emily brought up the issue of the conservative resurgence and the whole notion of the ends justifying the means. And sometimes when you talk to folks who've been in the SBC for a while, they'll hear someone say that and their ears will perk up and they'll get a little anxious because they'll go, well, the conservative resurgence accomplished so much good, right? There are all these things that happened as a result that improved the standing of the convention and improved the work the convention was able to do, its reach, so on and so forth. And that's the thing. A devil's bargain always has a carrot attached to it, right? It's not all hook. So to say that, well, All that this great thing happened, and okay, yeah, there were some bad things, and sure, maybe it wasn't done the right way, but look at all the good that resulted. I would pitch that that's just the nature of a devil's bargain. That's the story of Faust, right? So to anyone who's listening and immediately getting anxious because it sounds like we're, you know, calling out some stuff that's accomplished some good, here's what I'd pitch. At no point in the New Testament are we ever given leeway to say, well, good was done in spite of the fact that evil resulted. That's never how that works.
Yeah, that's right. And I think even, you know, the idea of, we'll look at all these good things, like, that's some cult nonsense. Like, we got to quit that. Like, that, I mean, yeah, that's the conversation over and over again with the conservative resurgence. Will this, whatever, like, I'm sorry, I learned in my Baptist college, in my biblical ethics class, that, like, circumstances do not dictate what is right and wrong. So we have the New Testament example of, like, the means being as important as the ends. In fact, they're what shape the ends, right? But then we also have the Old Testament example of, you know, the Israelites over and over again saying, but God, like, look at all this good stuff that we're doing. Like, we're following these laws and we're doing these feasts and we're doing all this stuff. And God repeatedly saying to them, like, I do not care about all the dumb stuff you're doing because you are behaving unrighteously, specifically toward people who are hurting, vulnerable, poor, oppressed. Like, and so if our argument is, okay, but look at all these good things, and those are an excuse for not dealing righteously with harm done to people, then, like, we are setting ourselves up to be judged by the God of Israel who cares about, like, right things in right ways at the right times for right reasons, not things that make us look and feel good.
And so for anybody listening right now that's in an SBC church, that's in your core, you love the SBC, this is part of what loving the church looks like, is exposing the sin and rooting that out and sitting with the uncomfortable stuff and picking it apart the way that the people on this podcast have, so that we can make it into something that resembles God's kingdom here on earth. And right now it doesn't. So we're going to sit here and we're going to be uncomfortable together and work through it a little bit. We don't have all the answers, but we can pick it apart a little bit and try to point us towards goodness. As Emily was just talking, she kind of took us through a history, but we had this guidepost investigation happen. That was something that was voted on in a meeting, correct? So the messengers, will someone explain what messengers are to just, like, a lay person real quick?
Sure. So the convention, when it convenes, right, churches send messengers, representatives to decide things. And so messengers are sent from churches to the convention to debate and decide on certain points of doctrine. We do that in something we call resolutions, which is where we try to express what Southern Baptists generally believe about something. There are a number of those that have been made with relation to sex abuse over the last couple of years, or, you know, how we view ministers who have committed sexual abuse, or these kinds of things. And then there are motions where people say we should do this, and there's a process for dealing with them. So messengers are essentially, they're delegates to the convention. The convention has power, or the messengers have power, to make change in the convention.
And they're making change at, like, a national level when they go to this meeting, right? So this is, like, large-scale organizational change.
Yes. Although a lot of times you got to be careful in the way that you word things or frame things. A lot of times things will be sent on or referred. They'll be sent to, you know, to a committee. And so what happened in 2021, when the pastors got up and made the motion for the investigation, it was referred to the executive committee. But everybody felt like that would happen. The executive committee is 86 trustees, right, and about 30 staff members who manage the day-to-day affairs of the SBC. So they were going to refer this idea for an investigation. But because they knew that that was likely to happen, the messengers voted, two-thirds of them voted in the affirmative to bring it out of referral onto the floor for a floor vote. That is something that is virtually unheard of on a number of times. David, did you want to jump in on that?
Just a brief note that I think is important for this conversation. Messengers are not all pastors. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure what the stats on this are, but I'm not even sure if they're majority pastors. So to be clear, when we're talking about people voting on this and referring this to committee, we're talking about not just pastors in the Southern Baptist churches. We're talking about a huge number of lay people, just ordinary Joe pew sitters from Southern Baptist churches doing this.
Yeah, people who care will go to their pastor and say, "Hey, I want to be a messenger," and then they go. You can have Joe or Jane, yeah, pew sitter, and they can go. So the messengers are the ones who vote for things. They voted for the investigation last year in Anaheim at our annual meeting. They voted to create the Abuse Reform Implementation Task Force. It's the worst acronym ever. The vote was to create this and that it would make suggestions about policies, and that also that they would authorize something called a ministry check database or website, which would have a list of offenders in various categories on it. And so that was voted on last year. And I would say pretty overwhelmingly that was approved.
Can you give me a little bit of a brief, what made 2/3 of the messengers care enough to do that? Was there some form of reckoning that happened? Was someone just loud enough all of a sudden? What turned the tide that they were willing to have an investigation done into the SBC at large?
Okay, so I think there's a few things. You have the Houston Chronicle, right? Those stories. I think what happened nationally is what happens locally. And this is, gosh, I hope I'm able to bring this circle all the way around. What I have heard several survivors say is that my abuse was painful and it hurt. But what hurt more was the fact that when I spoke up, everyone around me abandoned me. That no one came to my defense, which, by the way, is that is what being a shepherd is. You're a shepherd. You were supposed to defend people from wolves who are supposed to devour them. So if you don't care about abuse or don't think it happens, and you look at all the statistics and you look out at the fact and realize that 1 in 4 of the men in your church have been abused, and what, 1/3 of the women, and that doesn't move you and you don't care, find a new job. Anyway, moving on. But I think what happened is that as people were speaking up about this over years, and some of this has been going on, people have been coming to the convention and appealing as far back as 2008. So what happens is people started to get the suspicion that our legal representation and some of our inner counsel, our staff at the executive committee, were not responding properly to some of the requests for help that were being made. And so there was this growing concern that though people were saying, yeah, we're addressing it, we're handling it, we've produced this curriculum, that things were being suppressed or quieted or dealt with off, behind the scenes. And I think that that during COVID, we had a canceled annual meeting. And I think that the annual meeting kind of serves as a pressure release valve every year where everybody kind of gets together and all the junk comes out, and we deal with a bunch of stuff and then everybody goes home and takes some time off and then gets back on Twitter and starts fighting about stuff again. There was this growing feeling that there needed to be an investigation. When the motion was made and it was referred, instead of being voted on immediately and consulted, even though the pastor had posted that he was going to make this motion, I think everybody thought, nope. We're not letting this happen. It had been distributed widely enough, discussed enough, and I think people had had it. This issue, the fact that we're taking such a beating as a denomination, right? And I say this not to poor us. I just mean we're representatives of the gospel and of Jesus, and the fact that this stain, that our inaction, of our lack of action on this, the fact that this is still clinging to us, after us being alerted in 2008 and onward, people have had it. It's frustrating that we've not made more progress. And people, I believe, felt that they were being impeded by some of our leaders on the Central Committee. And the investigation, I don't know about anybody else. I'd love to hear from David or Emily. The guidepost report didn't really tell me anything new that I didn't already know, as much as it confirmed that our lawyers were often saying things like, don't answer that, or don't respond to that, or, you know, we don't have a responsibility. In my opinion, that's, you know, that's what we found, because we were suddenly able to access legal papers that were covered by attorney-client privilege.
No, that was definitely my experience too. I mean, when I read the report, that I'm sad to say there wasn't a bit of it that surprised me. I remember going over it with my dad, just talking about it on the phone, and him going, yeah, I mean, there's absolutely nothing in here that's shocking anyone who's been paying attention. But I think it's worth adding that anecdotally, this issue had reached the fever pitch that it did at the time that it did, but it's not as though conversation wasn't happening at the local church level about this kind of stuff going way, way, way back. I remember being a kid in 1995 and listening to a couple of adults talking about they called them music ministers back then. It was a much less sexy job than it is today. And in an SBC church two towns over, who'd, you know, apparently done something untoward. And even as a kid, I could understand it was sexual in nature. And one adult who I trusted very much said to another adult who I trusted very much, yeah, those music ministers, you got to watch out for those guys. Every church has at least one person like that in there. I mean, every church I've ever been a part of has got a person like that in there. And the other adult goes, yep, me too, absolutely. And I remember as a kid walking away from that conversation going, what? Like, everyone just knows that, like, apparently there's at least one person in every church who might do something absolutely horrifying to a child. And at, you know, 5 or 6, I didn't really know exactly what that meant, but I knew enough to be scared. That was going on in the mid-90s. So, Keith, I think you're exactly right. I think there was this really intense sense of, like, no, we're going to do something, and we're going to do it right the heck now. And the report that came out, unfortunately, just confirmed everything that people had been saying was going on.
As just like someone on the sidelines, advocacy wise, I will say reading that report was not shocking, because even being in this for the short amount of time that I have been, I knew it's worse than I know right now, even, and I know it's bad. It was overwhelming to see it all in one place like that, and to know that, like, this is just barely scratching the surface. It was horrifying. And yet it feels like nothing's happening. So I know that there's a ton of survivors that are furious, heartbroken, yelling at as loud as they can right now, like, where are you? What's happening? Do I not matter? My voice wasn't enough. And then you guys paid for this investigation, and like, that's not enough for you to start caring. Like, when are you going to start caring? Is it just empty void now that this report came out, or are there actual moves being made? So if you would like to explain the structure, like who actually has the power in these situations, that'd be really helpful for probably all of us, so that we can yell at the right person if we're going to meow.
That's right. First of all, I'm going to say, I'm not going to tell anybody to not say things to Bart, because even where he doesn't have power, he does have influence. You know, if you know someone's name who is in a national leadership position, like, talking to them is talking to a person who has influence. But, and then it's also talking to people who see that interaction, right? And so it's not wrong to do that. It's just not exactly right. And so the president of the SBC, the president of the convention, they are not in charge of, like, the day-to-day things of the collection of churches in any kind of way. Like, there's no pope, there's no presbytery, there's no whatever the Methodists call it, where they have, like, a council of people, and they, like, send someone somewhere, and they own the church building. And one of the things that we talk a lot about is autonomy, right? Each individual church chooses to participate, chooses to associate with a local association, which is usually at something like the county or in a rural area, like a multi-county level. And then there is the state convention, and then there's the national convention. You can sort of think about it as like a city government, a county government, a state government, and a church government, except In this version, the most authority is in the city government. The city can just decide to not be part of the state convention anymore, the national convention anymore. And it's not like they can send in the FBI and make them, right? Like it's, there's no enforcement from the top down other than not associating anymore. So sometimes things that people are talking about are a local church issue. And like the only thing that the national leadership can do is the credentials committee can decredential them. The convention can vote to disfellowship them. But like Bart Barber, the executive committee, like they can't go tell a church what to do. That church does not answer to them. Their property is not owned by them. They can do what they want. So there's that layer of complication. And then there's also all of the entities. So the entities are run on a trustee system, much like a governor will appoint like a board of regents to a public university. The main job of the president is to appoint people to like the big committees. And then those committees put people on other committees because we're Baptist. So the trustee system is recommended by the states and then appointed by the Committee on Committees and by the nominating committee, if you will, and then by the president. And so if something's happening at one of the seminaries, the executive committee of the SBC can't do anything about that. It has to be the trustees of that seminary. They're completely different legal entities. So when we say like they can't do anything, sometimes that is a cop out. And sometimes there are actual like legal barriers that prevent them from having any authority over that institution. And so the answer to that question that you asked a little bit ago is it's both yes and no. Like, yes, there are things happening. People like Keith are evidence of that. Like there are things happening at local church level, at association level, at state level, and at the national level. And it's also true that there are all these structural hindrances that make that long and slow and difficult and complicated. And it's also true that there are a lot of people who, one, don't want to do anything about it, like are antagonistic to doing anything, or two, have good intentions and have no idea how hard and deep and long and costly it's going to be to actually do righteousness in this. And so all of those things are true at the same time.
I want to add something to that in that it makes it very difficult for the entire organization to fall or fail when everything is disconnected like this. Like one individual seminary can have massive financial or enrollment problems and it not draw all the other seminaries off course, right? Like one organization can be thriving and one can be failing and struggling. The point here is that I know that there are some people who, you know, that I first started seeing it in comments. People are like, hey, burn this thing down. That would be like saying, I'm just going to light this one house on fire and all the houses in the United States are going to burn down. You're not accounting for distance. You're not accounting for fire departments. You're not accounting for the amount of water in the ocean. Like this thing is designed to survive. Think about it. It was founded by secessionists who didn't want anyone telling them what to do. And so they designed a system that requires them all to work together in order to accomplish things. In one sense, it is the most disconnected, decentralized, resistant, autonomous organization. And yet at the same time, if all the parts are working together properly, it functions. But this is why it takes an enormous amount of awareness to get an investigation. It takes an enormous amount of awareness for the people to read the investigation and come together and say, we agree upon a solution. Yeah, it takes momentum and time. Now, I don't say that. I want to just be clear. I'm not saying that as an apologist for the SBC, like whatever, you know, it's fine. We're doing everything we can. I don't make excuses for the organization, but I'm the kind of person who I can't stay in and I can't fight if I'm not an optimist. You know, if I don't see like, man, I'm the kind of person who I'm like, if I can just get all these levers and switches lined up right, this thing will work. Like it will happen. I feel like I can't abandon it and just leave it and say, hey, burn it down, because it will not burn down. That's just the nature of the organization. It's resilient.
Yeah, it might be worth adding that everything that you guys have just said, I'm not convinced that even the average Southern Baptist Convention pastor knows how this works. So like, I heard someone describe the SBC system recently as Byzantine, and like, I don't know if we've got any amateur history buffs listening who know why people refer to it. Well, actually, I would say that it's worse, because like the Byzantine system, as crazy and cracked out as it was, there was one guy at the top and what he said went, and the Byzantine system just had to figure out how to implement what he said. The Southern Baptist Convention makes Byzantium and its truly insane system that was so nuts that it's lasted, like there's a, we've got an adjective that's lasted 700 years into history. The Southern Baptist Convention system makes that look uncomplicated and really easy to understand.
Yeah. I think as somebody keeps laughing at me. And again, because people have
what
heard.
What else is there to say after that except, yeah. I mean, that, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, as somebody who just wants to like fix things, it's so defeating hearing it to be like, you've heard it on this podcast before. Every person on this episode has heard me in private conversations be like, I just want to burn it down, or I don't know why anyone is staying. What frustrates me is that I don't see a lot of powerful leadership within the SBC using their privilege and power to influence, like you were talking about. Like maybe they don't have the power to actually enact like a policy that actually does something, but it drives me nuts that I feel like I don't see them as angry as they should be at how gross this situation is and how disgusting it is that we're even having to have this conversation right now. And I'm voicing this because I think it's important to voice, because I know people listening right now feel how I feel, and it has to be addressed. It frustrates me that it's so hard to get smacked in the face with something like the Guidepost Report, and that it's so complicated that we can't even do the things that we need to do, like in an emergency situation like this. How has a church structure been built to the point that we can't even protect people from sexual abuse within churches without voting like 300 times on something? Like, that is so defeating to me. And what do you guys do with that? Like, what's your answer to that? Is there even an answer to that?
You are saying exactly what I've been thinking and feeling for a very long time. While this is not the only reason that I'm not a pastor in the SBC church, and that's a long and complicated story that we don't have to get into, it is a reason. And what I'll pitch is this. There are really two things here. One is the question of like, okay, why do the people who have influence in those circles, why are they not doing anything? A lot of this comes down to the culture that has arisen from the Southern Baptist power structure. Keith said it exactly right. Like, nothing gets done unless everyone works together to do it. And what that means is that to get anything done in the SBC power structure, you have to join hands with some people who will disagree with you violently on stuff. And so what happens is in those rooms, they have to talk to the folks they've got to join hands with that they know disagree with them in certain ways they know are going to pique their ego. They have to give certain amounts of ground to create a sense of compromise. All this frankly, nonsense, right, that has to go on to get it done. We joke a lot in the SBC about, you know, the 11th commandment being thou shalt not criticize another SBC leader in public. If you want to ensure that you get shut out of any influence in the SBC, that's the fastest way to do it. Say something critical about someone in power in the SBC. Like that, that's just boom, that's it. And the thing about it is that it will have your allies abandoning you too. So it's not as though there's this thing, Jonna, where like, okay, we've got all these people who agree on this thing and they can all kind of get together and push in this general direction. Unfortunately, that's not how it works, because as we're talking about a flotilla, like an entire armada of ships here. And the thing is, they don't all speak the same language. So like the various state conventions and the local associations are all their own little interlocking cultures. And here's where it gets really gross. If you were to burn it down, if
you were to somehow sweep the board completely of the thing that is called the Southern Baptist Convention, I am of the unfortunate opinion that somehow the problem would get worse. And here's why. Because now no one is looking. Those local churches will continue to exist, and the pastors who run them will continue to run them. Like, nothing changes there. And in some cases, the local associations and the ecumenical groups of churches that have gotten together, and they'll continue to exist. They'll continue to do things, and they will be, like, they're not really accountable to anyone now. But at the very least, they have a common enough association that, you know, folks like the people at the Houston Chronicle can go and, like, okay, we've got all these Southern Baptist churches, let's go talk to them. They just become a whole bunch of independent fundamentalist Baptist churches. And, like, I don't know if you've ever been to an independent fundamentalist Baptist church. I know some great folks over there in the IFB world, but it's toxic as all get out. Like, you want to talk about a hotbed for abuse? Find for yourself a church of about 150 people with a pastor who is the absolute law, 100% authority. There is no going over his head. There is absolutely no recourse of any kind, right? And he is, as far as these people are concerned, the arbiter and interpreter of Holy Scripture, right? Like, now you don't just have however many IFB churches there are in America. Now you've got the thousands and thousands and thousands of SBC churches in America all functioning that way. And there are wonderful local churches in the SBC that do not run that way. But the issue is that all of the rotten ones that do function that way right now are in some way getting eyeballs on them that they would not get on them otherwise, because they all exist in the same association. And to be abundantly clear, it pisses me right off that it is that way, because all of the existing survivors that have to function in the system have to deal with the fact that all of these absurd conversations and, frankly, abhorrent to the gospel ways of operating and moving in the world are going on. They have to deal with that. They have to keep crying out and keep getting re-traumatized, because gosh dang it, apparently we're just so blind and deaf to anything that Jesus has to say or do, or any of the wild smoke signals and red flags the Holy Spirit's throwing, that we keep platforming the same guys. It's truly mind-boggling. I apologize. I'm getting worked up, but that's neither here nor there. Maybe it is here or there. I don't know. The point is, I'm pissed off about it, and I don't know how I feel about it. There's a part of me that wants the whole dang thing to burn down. There's another part of me that is deeply concerned that somewhere right now there's a five-year-old boy, or a 12-year-old girl, or a 16-year-old teenage boy in a Southern Baptist Convention church who is in really close proximity to a predator. And maybe, like, God grant it, that the predator that is near them right now is thinking twice, because there are eyes looking at the SBC right now. That's my one hope. That is the thing I'm holding on to.
I would say this too, that the attempt at the database, you know, is an attempt to do something that addresses a problem that goes just beyond just dealing with the past, right? The database idea is something that only the national organization can do. Like, state organizations can implement. States can say, I just got a text yesterday. I was driving home from a concert my son put on, and I got a text from a pastor saying, "Hey, how do we get the Pathways event at our church? How do we get trained?" So our state can do that. It's easy. You don't have to call a national office and wait for, you know, this tiny little group of employees to schedule and get back to you. We've got 425 churches in Maryland. Like, we can get to you. We can train, you know, 10 people to do this training. And now we only have to train 42 churches each. And that's super easy when you're dealing with 9 entities, I think it is, 41 state conventions, 1,100 associations, and somewhere between 47 and 52,000 churches. National can't handle that. They cannot. But what they can do is they can say, look, we understand that at the end of the 30-minute crime show, right, when the police put the handcuffs on the guy and take him away to jail, that does not happen, right? That does not happen. And so you have 2 out of 3 sexual assaults go unreported, right? Out of 1,000 sexual assaults, 25 of those result in a conviction. A male abuser, this is from Emory University, who molests boys, has an average of 150 victims. 150, and one who molests girls has an average of 52 victims, and only 16% of victims ever tell anyone about their sexual abuse. So a database that authorizes us to use the results of confessions, right, that are made in a public forum, that allows churches to conduct investigations, and based upon a preponderance of the evidence, if the person is like very likely guilty, they can be entered into the database, means that we don't have to account for the fact that law enforcement is very, very bad at handling this problem. I know a lot of cops and I'm friends with them and they're good at their jobs, but the justice system isn't set up to handle this. And so what needs to happen is we need to say, yes, I was going to ask a long time ago, David, I think you were the one who said, you know, in our previous conversation, it's very hard to look at this all the time. It's a very difficult thing to look at this situation. I can't listen to 4 episodes of the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast in a day. Like, it's not something I can binge. Oh, this is great. Like, it's miserable listening to this show. You know?
Sorry, Jonna.
No, I know that. I tell people, we have survivors that'll be like, I listened to like 10 episodes in a 2-day span. I'm like, are you okay? Are you okay?
Yeah.
It's hard to listen to.
Did you book therapy like between every 4 episodes? Because like, who can do this? And I think our natural tendency is to say, gosh, I hope this never happens in our church. The average SBC pastor is trained as a theologian, preacher, organizational manager, not as a safety and prevention expert. And so you have to design a protection and safety system, right? And then you have to have this central information system, and it's got to be robust and it's got to be accurate. It's taken a long time to get to this place. Now, I say this not an apologist and not an excuse maker. I mean, I'm optimistic. I believe them that they're trying to get this thing out there. It's complicated, and I don't know how complicated it is. Do you know that you can't get any offender information from Chicago? Chicago's a sanctuary city, that there are no databases associated with Chicago. I just found this out the other day. Like, if the databases are incomplete and you've got to know an accurate history of where people live, like, you cannot rely on that to keep your church safe. You have to have your own database. We have more churches than there are McDonald's in the United States. This organization is massive. It's a level of organizational change, I think, that has not been attempted before. And so that's not to make excuses. It's just like, you have a bunch of theologians and preachers attempting massive organizational change. Like, it's chaos. We don't have the expertise. The experts who are speaking into this have differing opinions too about how to handle things. So it's complex. And I only say that to explain why it's taking so long, not as an excuse to inaction.
All of that kind of culminated into like why I even felt like comfortable having this episode, because I had to be kind of like convinced that it was worth it to even try to affect change within, because I'm so disillusioned on the outside. For listeners that are like, what the heck? For me, like, I'm like, run. But if you're there, if you're going to stay, then some serious work has to be done. This little group of us came together, and Keith has been doing a ton of work within his own state level to kind of come up with some ways, like, what do we do? We have just like this horrific thing that's staring at us that has more buildings and entities than McDonald's in the United States. And it's overwhelming. I mean, you're giving statistics here. Like, we are ripe to be preyed upon. All of these churches are. The church at large in America is. We have data within SBC that it's that bad. So what can we do? A lot of people listening, you have deconstructed. You may not even be a Christian anymore. You're maybe not at a church, or if you are at a church, you're still kind of like feeling out what that even looks like for you. So I asked, like, what are things that our listener base can actually do if they want to? And we came up with some action items. You do not have to be within an SBC church. You don't have to be a congregant there. You don't have to be in leadership at one to help with this. And I hope that just as humans, we can see this glaring issue and care enough that we want to try to make change. We want to try to get this space safer for kids and for vulnerable adults. So we have some action items.
Can I say one thing before we go there based on what you just said? I think that if it's meaningful to say from a Southern Baptist Convention affiliated pastor, there is no such thing, I think, as a Southern Baptist pastor, right? Your church is affiliated. I would say this, as a number of your listeners have probably spoken up or called people out or called them in, whatever the fashionable term is, they have been rejected. People have used scripture to tell them not to speak against God's anointed. They've asked them if they've followed the steps of Matthew 18. There's been a significant amount of rejection that comes with opening your mouth and speaking up and talking about the fact that you've been harmed by the church. And I think I would just say to your audience that for whatever it's worth, that I don't expect people who've been harmed by the church to dress themselves up and act like they're part of the church in order to speak in to the harm done by the church or the changes that are needed by the church. Like the voices that speak up make us uncomfortable because they're calling on us to do things that are uncomfortable. And if you judge the messenger because, you know, she doesn't share your political views or he doesn't identify with your spiritual beliefs anymore because they've been harmed and so you dismiss them, that's a cop out. It's too easy. I think we have to linger and listen to difficult voices who don't feel any obligation to conform to the beliefs of the church or the power structure of the church anymore because they've been harmed. What do we expect when people are hurt and rejected by the church except for them to reject the church? So I think there are people who say, how can I even start to talk back to this? How can I speak up? They won't listen. There are people who will listen. It's just uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable.
Let this man cook. Get him a gas top. Let's keep going.
I have an extreme aversion to platforming any pastors on this podcast, but your heart for listening to uncomfortable voices is a reason that I feel honored to have your voice here, Keith. So thank you for that. I really appreciate that. And you have really thought through this and you have a lot of wisdom and you've sought a lot of wisdom. And so I want to hear from you and from David and Emily, what are the things that, like, I'm activated, right? Like I'm a grassroots person. I'm upset. I know there's a bunch of stories in Acts 29. Let's start a podcast because they can't ignore us when there's when there's 50 some odd episodes that are all saying the same story because there's something rotten here. So hit me with it. What are some things that we can do? How can we link arms as humans to fight for change in this area in the SBC or the church at large? What are some things that we can do just as a human being that cares about protecting people from experiencing sexual abuse in the church?
There's some church things and not church things you can do. So one important thing you can do is if you live in a state where a clergy affair is not by statute abusive, in the same way that a physician or a counselor or a teacher is by statute a predatory relationship, then work to get a law like that on the books in your state. Work with your state legislature, because then that codifies for churches in that state that this isn't an affair. This is an abusive relationship. And so that gives, especially adult survivors, the force of law behind them. And it also has cultural effect, right? Like people don't look at someone as like, oh, well, she ruined this man's life. Like, no, like the state of Oklahoma, it doesn't, I don't think, like the state of Oklahoma says, like, this is a person in power preying on a person by means of their power over them and doing harm to them. And so it changes the conversation within the church itself to have those kinds of laws on the book. So that's something that You don't have to be connected to a church in any way. You can just advocate for laws like that on the books in your state.
A lot of times when something really awful happens in the government, there'll be like a resist bot and stuff like that. Like, write your senator. And you can feel like it doesn't really do anything. But I want to tell you now, more people are listening to this podcast than you know. And if you do it, it can make a difference. It can. I know it, or I wouldn't have put this episode onto this podcast. Like, I believe this community can actually affect change. And we have a couple more things that you can do personally to get involved. I think these are awesome things for you to do within your own local church if you're at one, but also to hopefully partner with your church leadership in starting to affect change within churches all around you. So sometimes, like, if you have a good relationship with your pastor or a church leader, ask them to call pastors in their area and talk to them about this stuff. Keith, would you like to talk about what you are doing in Maryland and some of the Pathways card and what you have as far as like resources for people?
I'll say this, that I think that we were positioned rightly. I think that the Lord set things up in Maryland that there were sufficient people who were interested in helping. We had a new hire who's a who's what's called our state director of evangelism. You know, he's over church health and church services. This is a man who had dealt with several abuse cases in his pastoral ministry, you know, and handled them rightly. Our current state executive has a severe special needs child who's just got, he's got enormous needs. Like, the rates of abuse for people with special needs like that are astronomical. The statistics that he can quote and the stories that he can tell about what have happened to other special needs folks are just, they're horrifying. And so he has been dealing with this for 20 plus years in his own family. And now he's our state director. We've got a fantastic children's ministry consultant and a number of pastors who care about this. And so for me and my friend Brad to have gone to our state convention and said, hey, we want to make a statement about this. Like, everything was just positioned for us to, I mean, it's just been amazing how supportive our pastors have been. They've got questions, you know, they want to know more. But we were able to pull together a task force, and we have something that we put together called the Pathways to Prevention and Protection. And the idea is that we want churches to be able to reduce instances of abuse. We want them to be able to, in the event of something, you know, happening, of an abusive situation being discovered, we want them to know what to do and how to respond. My personal conviction is, if you don't know what to do in an emergency, if you've not thought about it ahead of time, you're going to mess it up. You know, like, this is why we have kids do fire drills and safety plans. And, you know, it's why you say, where will you go if there's ever a fire in our house? Like, you work through those things. So Pathways is pretty simple. And I sent you the link, Johnny. You can put the articles that my friend Chris wrote. And she posted them on our state blog, and Baptist Press apparently really liked them and reran them nationally, which is kind of a cool thing. But it's basically, why is it important that you train your workers, and what should that training look like? How do you skillfully screen? You don't just want to background check people. You want to check references and things. What do policies that protect actually look like? And so this is the area where I think, when you talk about grooming, right? Groomers don't just groom children or vulnerable people. They also groom the community around them. And so when you have a set of rules that says doors always stay open, we don't give kids rides home, you know, we don't message except using this church app or email. When people break those rules or push up against them, and they are pushing back, and you're saying, these are our rules, like, these are our principles. And they're like, well, I just think in this situation, it's like, this is, alarm bell should go off. The policies are there to make trouble for people who would break them. And so develop strong policies that work for your facility and your ministry plan. And those are things that are highly localized. you can't just copy and paste somebody else's thing. One of the reasons why we're doing policy reviews, and we want to challenge churches to write their own policies, is because we don't just want them to copy and paste something that's not their own, they've not wrestled through. We want them to think about their facility, think about their ministry, think about the people in their church, and then develop policies that work. I wouldn't say, oh, you have to ban the use of this app, or you must have this rule in place, because I don't know your situation or your facility. You know, some rules that work in one place might not work in another. But so after you've got those things in place, and your state convention, if you've got an expert, you can call an organization, have them reviewed. Once you've got that in place, you have to have a plan to report. You got to know where to go, who to talk to. I would advise, and I did this with a funeral home when I was a young pastor, like, what do they do in there? You know, people started asking me questions. What are they going to do with my loved one? Well, I have no idea. Well, what is it like to go to file a police report? What's it like to go to the Child Advocacy Center? My secretary and I went to the local Child Advocacy Center, which has got law enforcement officials and people to take interviews. And we went, and we had called, and we said, hey, we want to come visit. And they were like, cool. And so they showed us through the whole building. And then they took us to a conference room and sat us down and asked us if we wanted something to drink. And we said, sure. And then all these people started coming in, and they were like, so what do you have to tell us? And we said, wait, what? And they're like, you're here to file a report, right? And we said, no. Like, we came to look and to find out. And they said, no one does this. Like, no one ever does this. Which everybody should go to the Child Advocacy Center. You should see it. Like, you should know who these people are that you're reporting to, and how to make a report. And then finally, you should know how to care. You should start to learn how to listen. I think listening to survivor stories on a podcast like yours is important. You know, that you listen to the fact that when they disclosed and then they were rejected, there was silence, people turned against them, people don't want to talk to them. Like, when you hear that stuff, you think, like, I mean, maybe you would say, I would never do that. But maybe you won't do that after you've heard the stories. You know, you need to hear the stories to learn what you're not going to do. And so you learn to care, and not just to protect the organization. Set aside money in a benevolence fund to pay for counseling. Figure out things that you need to do, or can you organize a community of people who've suffered abuse in the past who can help support others because they have that common experience. And so I think that the five components, I think that covers everything. I mean, maybe there's some insight that's not in there, but I think that those are the essentials. And so we want all of our churches to follow through on that. So I think that listeners could come alongside a pastor, or come alongside an associational leader or a convention leader, or whatever church structure they're interacting with, or any civic group they're interacting with. I mean, this works in any organization, those five things. And start to have that conversation. What's our plan here? What are the principles? Do we have a reporting plan? Have we thought about how we would care for someone in our organization? All those things, I think, are the essentials. And if you can build that at any level, local church, local association, state convention, it will be much easier to change national as these things become extremely normal in different organizations.
And Keith has an awesome card that we're going to link in the show notes that you can print out, and you can take it and you can give it to your pastor. You can take it to local SBC churches and ask to speak to that pastor and hand it to them and just say, hey, like, I care about this and I want you to care about this because I care about the people in your church being safe. So we've made it easy. You're going to have the resources printed out. We also talked about that anyone can go to state convention.
Anyone can attend a convention meeting. You would maybe have to register as a visitor or mm-hmm. something like that, depending on the state. Only messengers who are elected by participating churches can vote on things.
Right.
But I mean, like at my state convention in Oklahoma, you know, there's like a exhibition room with booths set up. And I used to go just hang out in that room for a day and see my friends from college and whatever. And so you could go spend 2 hours in an exhibition room at a state convention with a stack of Keith's flyers and give one to 70% of some state convention's churches.
So when we started talking about like who could people call, the director of missions is the title that came up. Can Keith, you are a director of missions, right?
Yes, but my local association does not like the term director, nor do they like the term that's attached to the latest in vogue term, associational missional strategist. They don't like the term strategist. So I am an associational missionary. Yeah, about 40 churches in the Eastern Baptist Association of Maryland. Yeah.
What could someone, would they Google director of missions? What would you Google? Like, I'll do Arizona. I'm in Arizona. I, during our call, Googled Arizona Southern Baptist Convention director of missions, and it came up with like seven names. And these people have areas underneath them. Tell me if I'm explaining this wrong, but they have areas underneath them where they are checking into those churches. And they are basically the people with like boots on the ground, finger on the pulse, what's happening in all these different areas of churches. We talked about what it would look like for everybody that's listening right now to do that in their area and then to work to get the Pathways card and start having these conversations with the different directors of missions in your state. You do not have to be an SBC church member. You don't even have to be a church member. You can find their email and their phone numbers a lot of the time when I've been looking. And you can call and just say, hey, I want to talk to you about this. Can I send you some materials? Is this something you would be open to bringing to your state convention or to the local churches that you represent and that you work with? Again, we'll have all this stuff linked in the show notes as far as the materials and resources for that.
Can I make a comment about the comment?
Yeah,
I think it's been mentioned already. Emily mentioned this. When Emily said before respectful, I would say this. I don't think that asking people to be respectful undermines the urgency of the conversation, the importance of the conversation. And it doesn't mean that you need to not be kind of pushy with the conversation. But what I do think is that podcasts and Twitter, there's a certain level of knowledge and shaping like that takes place on social media. I think social media is amazing at distributing information. The average Southern Baptist has no clue about this. And so you just can't, like, you can't expect to win them in one conversation.
Don't come in hot. Don't come in hot. Go slow.
Use your people skills and assess, because there are a lot of folks too who they're told, okay, you know, hey, you've got to implement Caring Well. And the Caring Well book is lots of pages and tiny type, and it's really good. But the pastor's already prepping sermons and fighting over the budget and trying to get somebody to work in the nursery and read this whole book. Like, I can't do this. So if somebody were to come along and say, hey, pastor, I've read up, I've done the research, I can help you implement a safety system in your church, or associational leader, I can connect you with people who can help you set up this training. Like, that's a much different thing than saying, like, are you doing this? Because a lot of people just have no clue. They just don't. And so, like, educating and being a friend and an ally and an advocate, I think is incredibly important.
Yes. And shame is never a good tool to use when you're trying to affect change.
Yeah. And I just also want to say, like, I think there's a lot of like, well, we have to hold them accountable. And I agree, but also accountability without people knowing what they're being held accountable for feels like being attacked. That is just a human thing. And so their response is probably going to be defensiveness, not out of antagonism, not out of not caring about it, but out of genuinely like interpreting the information that they have about the situation in a normal fight or flight human way. There are people who are legitimately antagonistic, right? Like anybody who's been on SBC Twitter knows that. Like antagonistic toward survivors, antagonistic toward doing anything. Like that's true. But then there are people that like, so I have a friend here in Norman that pastors a smaller church, very conservative, lots of little old ladies. He read the Guidepost report. Like he read it because he knew they weren't all going to read it. Like they're not online. They don't see it. They had a church meeting and he just explained to them, this is what this says. This is what this happening. And all of his little old ladies were like, nope. How do we sit? Like, how much does it cost to send you to convention? And so it's guys like my friend in their little tiny church with a bunch of old school 70, 80 year old ladies who, when someone tells them, then you give them the opportunity for them to say, no, we're going to do something. And then they do it, right? We don't want to prejudge people based on CBN Twitter. We want to give them the opportunity to be confronted with the truth, convicted by it, and then move toward action. And so when I say not antagonistic, I don't mean not angry about the situation, because like I'm plenty angry. I've burned all the bridges, right? but what I mean is that we want to give people the opportunity to hear the truth in a way that opens paths for them to respond well and rightly. And that's why it's so important for people to be in this work who are not survivors. People like me who are adjacent to some things maybe, but people who are not survivors. And so we're not putting expectations of feeling and interaction and tone on survivors, but people who are outside of that, who aren't carrying what they're carrying, can engage in the work in a way where we're putting the cost on ourselves to regulate ourselves, right? To be rejected ourselves, to bear all those things ourselves, so that we can give people opportunities to do restoration and reparative things, and then to also do protective things.
So I was just kind of like, when this started, thinking, why don't you guys just like kick out people like at the national level that won't get in line? Like, why, if a church doesn't want to put safeguards in place at a national level, it seems like you would just like kick that church out. I mean, we see churches being disfellowshipped for having female pastors right now, right? Like the national level decided that.
Well, I think you articulated a few of the principles right there. One, I think that you need to let everybody know, and you have to be clear, and it has to be, look, this isn't going to be an overnight thing. You know, we're going to ease into this. We're going to support it. We're going to put money behind it. There are organizations out there that offer safety assessments. There are churches that need some time to build things into their budget. And so associations and state conventions can underwrite subscriptions to, you know, background checking services. And there's a ton of them out there. You want to shop around and find a good one. But when you lay out the principles like we have, you tell people, we want to bring you all along. And so we're going to be out there doing these education components. And so right after convention, me and our state kids ministry consultant, Chris Buckman, we're turning the articles that I think you're going to include in the show notes. We're turning them into videos, and we're going to cut them down into smaller bite-sized things that can be distributed. You know, I think they call them reels on YouTube or Instagram or something. Like we're trying to get as much information out there as we can. But ultimately, you have to say, look, the programming within the SBC is all the churches are autonomous. And then people always say, that means no one can tell us what to do. But here's the thing. Every organization that associates has boundaries for association. You know, like we believe in certain confessions. We believe in certain statements of faith. If you don't endorse the statement of faith, you can't be part of the organization. On the national level, we have rules regarding like having racist beliefs. And if your church is racist and it is determined that like you are a white church and won't allow black people to join, you can't stay SBC. So we've laid out boundaries for cooperation and association. And you have to say, look, this is required.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The SBC did, in fact, very recently disfellowship a few churches over the issue of race, right? Did they not remove at least two churches?
Yeah, in the last few years, yes.
Yeah. So I say that to say that, like, what you're talking about here, like, has teeth.
It's got, and there's precedent for, yeah, you're allowed to be autonomous. You're in charge. We cannot tell you to fire your pastor, but we can fire you as a church. Like, we can just say, we don't want to affiliate with you. You have to be behind the culture change. Ultimately, I think the goal is not to exclude. The goal, like David was saying, you don't want to spin out 1,000 tiny little IFB churches and say, oh, there you go. You want to bring them into the fold and say, we want to support you. I think the average pastor has not thought through this and doesn't have all the connective pieces in place. But if you train them, and if you give them an environment, which is what we're planning on doing, where not only will they learn and be given the opportunity to read things, but we will, like, spend an extra hour on the Zoom call working through the documents as they write them. You know, like, we'll actually not send them home with the binder and the reading and say, okay, now go do it, but we'll do it right there with them. When you give people space and coach them through it and give them the ability to enact it, the likelihood that they're going to enact it is greater. Now, it's easier in a state like ours because we're only 400 churches. You know, a bigger state with 4,000 churches, they've got the staff and the finances to be able to put multiple people on it.
And if enough people are educating and putting pressure, I do think that can make a giant change. Like, you have to do is have the right person listen to you for multiple churches to start doing these things and to start caring. And if we could get...
Well, and the thing about it also, Jonna, is that, like, if every church in Maryland is doing this training, then that means that the trustees who are nominated and appointed to the executive committee board, the seminary boards, all these different boards, like, they're nominated from the individual state conventions, right? Like, it's representative, especially in the EC. And so, you know, if there's 4 or 5 states that are implementing things like what they're doing in Maryland and Delaware, then that doesn't just change the dynamics of that state. It changes the dynamics of the executive committee, because there are people who, at the culture of their state is, we will do this. And so then those voices who are coming from that perspective and that priority, those are the people who are involved in the local state are the people who get appointed to those national entity trustee boards. It's not just trickle up, it's that those are the people who are actually doing things at the national level.
This last idea that Keith actually had that I thought was brilliant, that is on our list of things that you can do. You don't even really have to have any interaction with the church beyond asking who their insurance policy is with. You can call a church, ask who their insurance policy is with, and then call insurance companies and start talking to them about this. Start talking to them about making sure that the churches that they are covering, that are their clients, are implementing abuse safeguards. Because when sexual abuse happens at a church, that's an insurance liability. And that's really gross. That's really gross to say. But at the end of the day, money means more than people a lot of the time when we're working for change. And that's not right. That should not be what it looks like in the church, but it's a reality. So if we have insurance companies that start requiring this, then we don't have to wait on the church to get with it, because they won't be able to have insurance coverage without it.
If I can just put, there's this unhealthy cycle. I think, like, there are a lot of churches where the trustee board is deathly afraid of losing their insurance for any reason, right? You know, like, we've got to keep our insurance intact, right? And what's coming down the pike, I believe, in the insurance industry, if not in the next 5 years, but in the next 10 years, church companies that insure churches are going to want them to have these policies in place. And so I think it can even be just one of those things that people mention as they're talking, just saying insurance companies are going to require this. Like, you have to start getting moving on this, because when they drop the hammer in 5 years, wouldn't you rather have been prepping for 5 years and getting ready rather than suddenly we have to put all this stuff in place or we're going to lose our insurance? It's every trustee board's worst nightmare that the insurance is going to fail. Find out if the insurance company will help implement. Sometimes they'll give a discount if a church is trained. Like, there are, yeah, insurance is an angle. And yeah, it does feel kind of slimy, but at the same time, it also makes sense.
It also feels kind of punk rock, which is like the way that I like to do things. So like, all right, well, then I'll just go to the insurance company. You know, I like to ruffle feathers like that. Okay, I want to ask a final question now that we have a few of those ideas out there for listeners to get involved. I want to know, like, what's your why? Like, why do you guys as individuals care about this? Why are you fighting for this? Like, what is driving your desire to, like, have this conversation and to hopefully inspire other people to start having this conversation?
So my experience has been over and over again to be next to things, to be the person who's disclosed to be the person who is adjacent to all of these situations. So I think having that sort of proximity over and over and over again in all these different areas of my life has given me a perspective of it. I think another thing is that because I have chronic illness and because some of that chronic illness is related to being a woman and having been a woman in the SBC, I know what it is to be a woman in the SBC, just that. And then to also carry this invisible thing that is attached to my femaleness and my body that people can't see. And so even though it's not the same, I just have this sort of kindredness toward it, of feeling like that I know what it's like to hold that and to have it be dealt with rightly and not dealt with rightly, and how big of a difference that makes. And then also to know how Jesus deals with that, right? Like, we literally have a story about it in the Gospels of a woman who is dealing with an issue that, instead of being supported and cared for, is treated as a thing to be ashamed of, even though it's not a result of anything that she's done. And the way that Jesus responds to her is so different than the way that we often respond to a woman who has a bleeding disorder, or to a woman who is abused, or to a child who is abused, or a man is abused. We so often turn it into a thing of shame instead of into a thing that has happened to them that they are carrying around invisibly in their body, and that it's affecting them all day, every day. And so there's that aspect of it. And then the other thing of it is that, like I said, I love the SBC. Like, there are a lot of bad things in my SBC experience, and there are a lot of incredible things. Like, my best friends now to this day come from the job I had as a teenager at an SBC camp. I got an incredible education at a Baptist liberal arts college. I got to serve in incredible churches. And so the SBC is a positive thing to me in a lot of ways. And one of the things that I think is really important to do is that when we have benefited from something that has harmed other people, then it is our responsibility before God to not just take that benefit without addressing the harm, and without using our position and our privilege as people who have that connectedness to the SBC to not do everything that we can to set things right. And so that's the reason that I always talk about it in terms of we. Like David said, we accidentally earlier and kind of laughed, but I always say we. I'll say we forever, because I was formed by it and I formed other people in it. It's not they, it's we. Like, I was there. I don't know where I am right now, but for 40 years I was there. Like, I was deep in it. It's we. And so I really feel a deep responsibility before God for what I do toward other people in terms of the SBC. And then the last thing is just that, like, man, that education that I got in those churches and in college, it taught me to take scripture seriously. And the God of the Bible takes seriously harm done in the name of Jesus. I am not going to ever be okay with us saying all of these things are fine because look at this gospel message that we're doing. Look at this gospel work that we're doing. I grew up caring too much about Lottie Moon to let that mess happen in her name. I grew up caring too much about Annie Armstrong to let that mess happen in her name. I grew up caring too much about the ladies in the WMU in my little dysfunctional First Baptist Church in a county seat to let that mess happen in their name. I took seriously what I learned in the SBC. And so I'm going to continue to be serious about it. And this is what that looks like right now to me.
I've said for a while now that, you know, the church has a lot of, there are multiple stewardships that you need to balance as a pastor. You have a responsibility towards the organization. You have a responsibility towards your workers and your people. You have a responsibility towards the people in your care, and you have a responsibility towards the gospel. And I think that, and the reputation of the Lord Jesus. And I think what's happened is so often we've gotten it backwards where we've said, we have to protect the reputation. We have to protect the organization by sacrificing the individual. And that's the very thing that drags the name of Jesus down. When we prioritize the individual and we say, we're willing to do what's right, even at the cost of our own hurt, you know, to protect the individual and to say this was wrong. That's the very thing that I think the world sees, that the individual who's been harmed sees and says, okay, if it is true, and I'm not a survivor, so I don't know, but if it's true, and I believe that my survivor friends who've told me this, they're speaking the truth when they say it, that the abuse hurts and it harms. But what hurt worse was the fact that they were abandoned. If wrong happens, how can we not do everything we can to try to make that right and to try to prevent it for others? You know, my why, honestly, comes down to a few things. I was taught that men were supposed to protect women and the vulnerable. That's my complementarianism. I don't know what happened to complementarianism since seminary, but it's turned into this, like, shut up, women thing. That's like, that's not like, I don't know. How did it get to that? But like, protect, right? I was recruited into this conservative, we believe and obey the Bible and do the right thing denomination. Like, whatever effects have come out of the conservative resurgence that are negative, the story that was told that I believed in and moved the church into the denomination based on, like, I still believe that. This is what it means to be the best. Like, you do what you are obedient to scripture. And so, you know, there's that. And then there's the people who along the way have decided that you are the only person. And so sitting in my house with my wife, somebody tells us the most guarded, terrible thing that's happening to them or that they've been through. How do you not shepherd that person? Like, how do you bury it? I mean, I think it's the nature of what it means to be a shepherd. And it's not easy. Sometimes it's terrifying. You are not trained for this, but you jump in and you help. Like, that's what it means, right? That's what shepherds do. I had somebody comment on a tweet and say, you're not a shepherd. There's only one shepherd. Peter calls us under shepherds, under the shepherd, you know, and we're working for him. This is his flock. You know, we're called to care for his sheep. We treat them with dignity and respect and care. That's the why. Is it's the assignment. It's the job you took when you took the title pastor.
For me, this matters on two tracks. And one, of course, is very personal and very moment to moment in that I don't think anyone can reasonably call themselves a minister of the gospel, or even reasonably call themselves a minister or call themselves a Christian or a follower of Jesus and walk past the road on the other side while the man on his way to Jericho is laying there beaten to death in a pool of his own blood. I don't think you can do that. And I don't think that all of the excuses that we make to not listen and act and to not take radical, self-effacing, costly action, I don't think they matter in that routinely across the ministry of Jesus, he is always listening to and receiving feedback from people whose very existence and identities ought to have rendered them invisible to him. I think of the Syrophoenician woman who he initially refuses when she asks him to heal her child. And her response to him causes him to react to her. Now, that's obviously a very complex story in the Gospels, but I relate it to say that by rights, to a Jewish rabbi, a Syrophoenician woman with a sick child, it like doesn't exist. Right? He should see her as no more than just another face in the crowd, and yet Jesus is responsive to her. The Samaritan woman at the well is an easy layup on that one. And you go on and on and on with example after example after example. I cannot envision a coherent, meaningful Christianity that is not prepared to respond to these kinds of things, and that is not prepared to act radically. But then on a cosmic level, Emily touched on this really, really well. So I guess I would just round it off by saying that the gospel is not merely... I shouldn't even say merely. It's not a get out of hell free card. It's not a, well, you know, I stamped my hand with, you know, whatever it is that the Holy Spirit puts on you when you exercise faith. And, you know, now I'm kind of get to practice my get out of hell free card and raise my hand in worship and, you know, cry occasionally in Easter when the pastor preaches a particularly good sermon and call myself a Christian. That ain't it. The gospel is an announcement that there is a new kingdom coming into the world, a kingdom that doesn't operate on the principles of Caesar, does not operate on the principles of power as we understand it. It is a kingdom that intends to obliterate evil, that will obliterate evil, by forcing that evil to walk over the bodies of the slain. Like that's exactly how it's going to get done. Christians are like, I believe that the church, and when I say the church, I mean capital C, universal church, is going to win in the end because, gosh darn it, they can't kill all of us. And it's not because we're going to fight with our fists. It's not because we're even going to necessarily fight with the weapons of war or of politics or any of these things. What we are going to do is, if we're following the example of Jesus, is we're going to fight via self-sacrifice. And I will be damned, and I mean that word in the theological sense, I will be damned before people who call themselves pastors get to get up in pulpits and pop a squat on survivors because it preserves their institutions and say that they're ministers of the gospel. No, thank you. Abso-freaking-lutely not. And I will doubly be damned before a whole bunch of pointy-headed bureaucrats trying to maintain institutions at paychecks get to say, don't answer that and just say no comment and you know, sign this and, you know, stick it in my desk when you're done, to represent Jesus to a watching world that is in dire and desperate need of his kingdom. That I won't do it.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed here are the speaker's own and not those of this podcast. This content is presented for informational and educational purposes that constitute fair use, commentary, or criticism. While we make every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, we welcome any comment, suggestion, or correction of errors.